Hello and welcome to Transmission. Today we're joined by Rebecca Sedler, who is the Managing Director of National Grid Interconnectors, and we are talking all about interconnection. From the gigawatts of cables already in place to the future of the market, we cover how it technically operates, but also some detail on the commercial rules that guide these systems. Critically, how do they work for consumers, and do consumers see the benefits of interconnection in their bills? Finally, should we build more interconnection or are they disrupting markets? Let's jump in. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to Transmission.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me here.
And as always, let's get started off with who are you and what is your role?
So I am the Managing Director of Interconnectors at National Grid. So my name's Rebecca Sedler. I've been in role for about 2.5 years now. And the Interconnectors business at National Grid owns and operates 6 subsea HVDC assets. We'll try and keep away from acronyms during the conversation. I realize I've already done it. Connecting the UK grid to 5 different countries. So France, Netherlands, Belgium, Norway, and most recently Denmark. I'm also responsible for setting the vision for the business, developing all the new projects, and we'll talk a bit more about those hopefully.
Okay. And let's focus on the real basics of this. So what is an interconnector?
An interconnector is part of our high voltage network. Apart from it's not domestic, it connects the UK to other countries. And so far, interconnectors have connected the UK to other European countries. So the ones I just mentioned, plus there's independent developers that have connected the UK to Ireland, Northern Ireland, and there's one on the way to Germany. So they are cable that runs subsea, they're buried underneath the seabed, and when they land on shore, they have to be connected to something called a converter station, and that's essentially to convert the power so it's suitable to flow into our AC grid, our normal high voltage grid, which can then be distributed to households and businesses across the country. But what's, I think, special unique about interconnectors is, one, they flow very large loads. So the smallest one in our fleet is a gigawatt. That's enough to power nearly a 800,000 homes, I would say, in the UK. The largest, 2 gigawatts. So that's IFA, the oldest interconnector we have to France. And they're incredibly flexible. They can literally flex direction from one country to another in minutes, if not seconds. So the whole purpose of this connection to different energy systems across Europe is to enable countries that have high energy prices to import from countries with lower energy prices. And of course, those prices, as you know, set by the scarcity of the energy systems and the many different variables that go into that. So what we have in the UK are interconnectors that allow us to plug in to different energy sources, that allow us to import when our prices are high, but also to export when we have very low prices or even negative prices. And they also provide system operators on both sides of the link the opportunity to use these highly flexible assets at times where the systems may need that flexibility to provide wider grid services.
Okay, so if we turn that into like a real world example, we might say it's really sunny in the UK and it's not sunny at all in continent, then we might be flowing energy from the UK to continent, and that's kind of balancing those networks. And then let's say we have a problem in GB, so for whatever reason, a large part of our generation mix goes missing suddenly. Let's say a nuclear plant trips. We then, the TSO, who are responsible for managing the transmission system, then say, actually, no, we'd rather not have that flowing in that direction. We're going to flip this back the other way, and we're going to rely on France, Denmark, etc.
Yeah, so you're precisely right. So, I mean, you could have a look at this from big long-term trends. So, for example, are we going to achieve the renewables build-out that we're hoping to do so in the UK and in the 2030s, where we have loads of low-cost, cheap wind that we'll be able to export to European countries in that decade and onwards, through to intraday, does the UK have breakfast and therefore morning peak at the same time as France? Does it have its dinner at the same time as the scarcity? And of course, all the things affecting that scarcity, like weather patterns, distance heating, cloud cover, etc. What do they mean? And quite often on our links, what we see is that there are import and exporting in the same day. I mean, the circuit breakers and the converter stations work very hard to, you know, stop the flow, reverse the flow. I was actually looking this morning before I sat down on what we're importing into the UK today, and 16% as we speak of energy consumed in the UK is coming in via interconnectors. So, and you can see it's a nice warm sunny day here, at least in London, not quite as warm as it's been, but that could easily reverse to a much smaller or even increase in the hours to come. They are highly flexible assets.
And I really like how you've kind of, so the example I gave was a generation example. So, you know, generation is a bit variable and all of a sudden interconnectors can do different things. Your example was the other side of that, which is the demand side.
Yeah.
And you're essentially saying, well, actually, because of the time difference and because the nations have different cultures and standards of when they eat their breakfast, when they eat their dinner, you can then, there's a naturally a different shape, even for markets that are quite close to each other. And so even if you don't get generation volatility, the demand volatility creates shape and creates this need or this opportunity to connect them.
Yeah. I mean, what's really interesting is when people talk about interconnectors and they talk about, okay, the Norwegian interconnector to the UK must all be about hydro, or the France interconnector must all be about nuclear, whereas it's never one specific thing that sets the price in the country. Obviously, there can be very extreme events that mean that, you know, they're like, for example, in 2022, during Q4, during the winter in France, there was significant nuclear outages that sent the price very high, you know. But there's a whole load of things, as you say, consumer behavior, weather patterns, what's happening across the rest of the borders with their interconnectors. All these countries are interconnected to loads of other countries that have completely different energy systems as well. So it's a little bit more complex than just picking like a dominant generation feature or a particular weather pattern.
If we're better to find countries that are different to us, should we try and find countries that are sort of really far away, either sort of east, west or north, south? Why don't we sort of have a massive interconnection that goes, say, spanning Europe?
Well, I mean, National Grid owns and operates the longest interconnector in the world, which is the Viking Link, which connects us to Denmark, which is about 750 kilometers long. And clearly, you know, we are looking at longer and longer projects, and we hear about those in the energy press. I think there's a huge amount of benefit to be gained from very uncorrelated energy systems, but of course there's a cost to that as well. There's the cable, which costs a lot of money per meter. Laying the cable is a huge effort, and you know, just the size of the construction effort, the tenure of that, from project development to construction to operations, you know, you'll be having to plug in a lot of capex before you start operating the asset and seeing the benefits.
Okay. And then, well, you mentioned the cost of it, but then there's also, I suppose, the cost of actually operation for a really long cable. So as they get longer and longer, do you lose more energy in that cable?
There are losses with the longer and deeper, but technology is evolving all the time. It really is. And with the cable technology is evolving, the ways of laying the cable, the ways of maintaining the keeping them secure. So that wouldn't be a predominant feature in the economics. It would actually more be the raw materials, the manufacturing of those raw materials, the production processes, the testing process to produce the cable and then build the converter station and plug the whole thing up, that would consume a lot of the capex.
Okay, so really kind of capex heavy, and the sort of losses aren't the most kind of important part of the business case. You've gesticulated a little bit at a prop that you've brought along, and this is a bit of a transmission first. I'm not sure we've ever had a prop on transmission yet. It is, for lots of people, an audio experience, but we will do our best to describe the prop that you've brought. And for anyone on video, then you're in for a treat. So, Rebecca, would you like to describe what you've brought along?
Okay. So I have bought a section of subsea cable for you today, Ed. So it's actually a small cutting from the IFA 2 cable. IFA 2 is the second interconnector that we built to France. It's about, I don't know, 5 centimeters high, would you say? Maybe a bit longer, and about the width of the diameter of a pen. Okay. And what you'll see, and we have two of these cables, running from our converter station in Portsmouth to Torb in France, running underneath the channel. And I brought it in because I think it's really interesting first to pick it up and see how dense it is. Mm. You know, like a meter of one of these cables can weigh between 40 and 50 kilos, right? So just think about what it takes to lay hundreds of kilometers of it, what kind of vessel it takes, the kind of effort it takes. But also you can see the many different layers when you cut open the cable. So the copper core is actually a minority aspect, isn't it? Because then it's surrounded by different insulation.
It feels like the copper portion protection. Of it, it's like 30% of it maybe.
I know. And it's just amazing. I just find it a wonder to look at this and think, out of that copper core of that cable, we transmit 500 megawatts subsea from the France to the UK. I just find it, you know, an engineering feat.
And so the inside portion, the copper portion, that's where the transmission is happening. Yeah. Everything else on here is all around insulation and protection.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And, you know, so the density of it, and there's, don't ask me to explain why we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, multiple layers, what they all do. But what I can tell you from working with our partners, this is a cut of Prysmian cable, who are a huge vessel owner, operator, cable manufacturer, key partner for National Grid. You know, the upstream aspects to producing this cable is incredibly complex and expert and fascinating, really fascinating.
And you said this is from IFA 2. Mm-hmm. So is IFA 2 just one of these across
two,
the channel?
Two of these cables.
Okay. And then do they sort of sit side by side, or are they split? How does that work?
They'll be close to each other, but they will be laid separately.
Okay, super interesting. And we were also, I think I know a little bit about this, but I'm really interested to think about or to talk about, how do you actually make this?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I'm not going to profess to be an expert on how you make it. All I can tell you is huge factories, generations of workers who are highly, highly trained and skilled in being able to be part of any part of the process of producing this, and huge amounts of testing before it's able to, you know, be released into projects. So if any section of this gets contaminated and gets put onto hundreds of kilometers, can you imagine the devastating impact?
The cost of actually having to unwind that.
But also the laying process, which is, you know, in this case done by the cable manufacturer, is just fascinating. You know, these huge boats that look like, I don't know if you've been on a cruise, they look like a Caribbean cruise boat, but they've got these things that look like moon buggies that are out of the old James Bond film that they deploy subsea, you know, hundreds of meters to the sea, that dig the trenches, that, and then the cable can uncoil and they can blow the sand or whatever the seabed is made out of, try and cover it and pat it down. It's just a fascinating process.
And it's just this fascinating thing where essentially the one thing you kind of can't do with one of these is you can't sort of break it or kink it. So the vessels have to be enormous to be able to get sort of wide enough coils onto the vessels.
That's it. I mean, they look like, you know, like a what you would put a needle and thread, you know, like a big, big turnstile, but it's huge. And you have to make sure that the diameter, that the angles are such that the cable isn't overbent or damaged in any way and laid really precisely. But it's huge.
Okay, let's come back to something you mentioned earlier. So you mentioned that there are sort of these landing points, these control rooms for interconnectors. What do those control rooms do?
So the control rooms operate 24/7 to monitor, maintain, and ensure the safe operations of the interconnectors, but also to be the point of call for the NESO control room, because of these are, of course, critical national infrastructure. They're incredibly flexible. They don't just operate according to markets. They operate according to our system operator instructions. And also they need to be talking to the control room at the other side of the interconnector at all times, right? So we have control rooms based on site. We also have some based at other locations. But actually, if you're thinking that, you know, every hour that customers are nominating the flows on these interconnectors, people are pressing buttons and, I don't know, pulling levers and, you know, to kind of manage it, that's not the case. The assets are operated by what we call control and protection systems that are largely automated, and they're automated according to where customers are nominating the capacity, and those nominations, as you can imagine, follow what the market price is determining, right? Up to, you know, day ahead and intraday.
Yeah. So when you say nominating capacity, that's essentially somebody has seen an opportunity to flow energy, let's say, from England to France, and they will say, right, actually, I have this capacity that I've bought. I now want to nominate to flow energy through it.
Exactly.
And that would maybe be the first stage. But the second stage be that closer to delivery, the system operator would sort of get a last look at that and have a potential to intervene.
Well, the customers will nominate their capacity. If the system operator, so before you go operational with an asset like an interconnector, you of course need to, you know, ensure that you're compliant with grid code. You need to also have an operating protocol agreement with both with the SOs and with the TOs, so the transmission, the asset owner, so National Grid, and in IFA's case, RTE. And part of that will be the ways in which the system operator can use the asset, if you like, for grid services. So things like emergency instruction, emergency assistance, should you need to. And we do see times where the system operator will kind of buy the customer nominations out, or buy consumers out of the nominations, and choose to flow the interconnector potentially another way. Just to be really clear, National Grid never flows energy on the interconnector. Mm-hmm. We are asset operators. We maintain the safe, secure, reliable asset for market traders and different utilities and consumers to buy and nominate that capacity. And of course, for the system operator, NESO or RTE in this case, to use it, but National Grid would never flow energy.
Yeah, so just within this, I know there's if you've worked in energy for quite some time, maybe things like National Grid will feel like it's an all-encompassing thing, but really here we mean National Grid, the thing that owns the assets.
Exactly.
And NESO being the thing that has the control room. Yeah. And so the asset ownership and the dispatch of it are very, very different things.
Yes, it will be dispatched by our control room, so the National Grid control room, but the system operator can send an instruction to our control room as to how they want to dispatch if that isn't in line with just the nominations that have been put on the different interconnectors.
Okay. And just to, you can see now, I think, hopefully, how interconnectors are helping grids manage problems that they have. What happens if an interconnector has a problem? So what happens if somebody has dropped an anchor in a storm and that cuts through one of these cables, which is hard to imagine because it looks incredibly robust, but it is possible. What happens next?
First of all, it's worth pointing, as you say, they are incredibly robust. They are buried underneath the seabed. And, you know, we do the control rooms, one of their many responsibilities is also monitoring vessel activity around the cables, okay, right? So vessels are detectable by the systems that they have, monitoring systems that they have. And we can see, we literally have screens that show exactly what boats are going near our cables, how long they're near our cables, if something's heading towards them. So that's a key part of the interconnector control room. But you're right when you say anchor. I mean, when I came into this job and I was like, okay, they might drop an anchor by accident, I was thinking about something maybe the size of this table we're speaking at. Actually, some of these anchors are the size of this room that we're in, right? So they could damage. And thankfully, we've not had any kind of anchor drop episode since I've been in interconnectors. But I think the understanding and deterring vessels away from your assets with the help of other agencies such as the Coast Guard is really, really important. But also, so having the ecosystem of support with your supply chain and your preparedness plans in place, just in case something like that does happen, right? Because, you know, if there was some kind of an anchor strike that we hadn't detected, let's say we weren't able to monitor, there could be a load of vessels out and we don't know precisely which one. We have to first detect where that strike has taken place. We have to understand if there's, you know, whether it's a go in, get the permission to go in and send a vessel ourselves to go and look at the damage. So that means sometimes recovering the cable from the seabed, which will mean the opposite of what I've just described to you in terms of laying the cable. You have to do exactly the same to expose the cable and examine it. You'll then have to cut a section of the cable.
Okay.
And get a new piece of cable to then join and rebury it. That's essentially the process you need to go through, right? But that means having the support of cable repair vessels. That means having the permit so you can get out in the sea. That means having spare cable, which of course we have for all our assets. Mm-hmm. That means having availability and the conditions to do so. So, you know, a lot easier to do this in June than it is in January, right? In the North Seas. So, you know, all those things. So preparedness is a huge theme for us and essentially underpins our resilience. And so that can mean not just having kind of business prepared plans that you can operate to, but the supply chain with the right services and the right contacts that we can act at pace.
I think one of the things I love about the energy industry is sort of the engineering ingenuity that goes on and kind of having ready questions to how do you repair an interconnector that is broken but is at the bottom of the ocean is exactly a great example of just how complicated, but actually if you break these things down and you kind of have these right processes in place, hey, you can manage that.
Yeah. And I think the seabed conditions and the, you know, and the depth of the water, of course. I mean, we are blessed in the UK with the North Sea coastal conditions that are shallow and that are soft. But, you know, if I think about where we connect into in Norway, for example, mm-hmm. and it kind of comes in to a place called Kvildau in Norway, which is actually really up a mountain right next to a big, very big hydro station and kind of on the edge of a fjord mm-hmm. that pretty much drops to 800 meters, less than, you know, 100 meters offshore. So it's completely rock. It's very, very different seabed conditions.
And it tracks the seabed all the way through all of that. Okay.
And then, you have to drill through mountains and stuff then to get it to the converter. So everyone assumes that, you know, it's most tricky to fix subsea if there is an issue, which is probably right, but it's very tricky as well sometimes, and it takes a huge amount of expertise to do the onshore, because for all different kinds of reasons the geology could be complex. It could also be congested area.
Yeah. Okay. And let's move on from the technical side to the commercial. So you mentioned that you have 6 interconnectors that you oversee. How many gigawatts is that?
So 7.8.
7.8 gigawatts. Okay. And what does that look like in the future?
So we are already developing our next project, which is Lion Link, which is 1.8 offshore hybrid asset. So slightly different to a point-to-point interconnector, which I've described before. So this is Lion Link will be an offshore hybrid asset connecting the UK to the Netherlands, has an in-service date of 2032, but it will also pick up Dutch wind along the way. So it will be the first interconnector that can not just export and import energy from another European energy system, but it can also import wind energy directly from a European offshore wind farm. Okay. So that's super exciting for us.
So it's kind of stopping at a wind farm on the way, is that mm-hmm. right? And is that a physical island or is that a sort of a platform?
That's a platform. So it's part of TenneT, who are the Netherlands transmission system owner. They have something called a 2-gigawatt program where they're doing a huge build out of wind across the North Sea coast, and they're connecting it via a series of platforms. We'll be connecting to the third of those platforms. So yeah, that project's well underway. And we're very excited that because we do believe there's huge scope for coordination mm-hmm. with different offshore technologies, of course, offshore wind, but maybe in future years, other things in the North Sea. And so finding innovative ways for us to connect transmission and generation and bring it onshore in a coordinated way, which lessens the burden on communities and which saves on infrastructure of, you know, raw materials, all the different services I just talked about with constructing and operating the asset, we think can be hugely beneficial to consumers.
Okay. And we have, you mentioned this new asset coming online by 2032. Mm-hmm. Just in broad terms, then, are we thinking the portfolio of interconnection will double or triple from there? Or do we think it will be more of a sort of, by the time it gets to 2035, we'll see an incremental increase in size?
We have also other projects we've got a quite healthy pipeline, and we have other projects that are similar scale to Lion Link as well. I guess that we so in the UK, we were working to a policy target of 18 gigawatts of interconnection in the UK. That was set in the white paper about 4 years ago that came out with the last energy bill, the one before the recent one. But it's clear that by 2030, we're not going to have developed that much interconnection in the UK. I think overall, there's going to be about 12, maybe, by 2030, 12 gigawatts. So that's obviously falling short of the 18 gigawatts. What we believe, though, that we need to set a firm policy target that we can work to for that's underpinned in CP30 and beyond, and has the as a coordinated network plan as well. And that we are working to 2035 for National Grid. We believe that we could add a significant amount of volume to our interconnections with other European partners, all having very strong consumer cases.
Okay, and Clean Power 2030 being the plan that's in place for the power system in 2030. You mentioned that Lionlink was going to go live in 2032. Just to give people an idea of how long have you been thinking about Lionlink, is this something that was sort of imagined last year, or has this been running for many years?
No, it's been running for at least about, I'd say, 3.5 years now with the Netherlands, and it has also gone through different designs and, you know, looked at different landing points, a different engineering development, but we're now moving forward at pace. We now have we're supported by a regulatory deal, which underpins the investment. We have the, we're pretty well progressed with that.
Okay, and so it's around 10 years-ish sort of start to finish to get one of these put together.
But yeah, but I must point out that Lionlink is more complicated than a point-to-point because of the fact that we're hooking up into the platform, we're connecting offshore wind, so it's a much more multi-party coordination, which is always a bit more complex, and it's first of kind. Yeah, first of kind, like technically, and also from a sort of market and regulatory framework. So we had a pilot regulatory deal to enable us to do Lionlink. It's almost like a sandbox project. So it was great to see that Ofgem continues to support the innovation of interconnectors and sees the potential for what they can do in the future.
Okay, well, let's get into that. So commercially, how do interconnectors actually work? How do you get paid?
Okay, so, you know, we've talked about this great big wire that we have buried in the sea connecting these two different countries, and the value being that you can flow energy from the cheaper energy system to the more expensive energy system, which creates a price spread, an arbitrage opportunity. I guess our job as National Grid for our interconnectors is to decide, well, when do we sell that capacity? And so we have different traders, utilities, other organizations wanting to buy it for various reasons. It can be just because they actually have businesses in different energy systems and they want to hedge those businesses. But it can also just be they're speculating on the markets. So we sell the capacity in long-term auctions right through to day-ahead auctions, and we create a kind of a glide path of when we want financial certainty, if you like. And also, you know, we have to account when we're taking outages and things like that, and give the customers assurance of when the asset will be available. And then the value of that, I guess there's two kinds of value to that. And I know you've worked in trade, so I'm going to use terms that you'll be familiar with, others might not. But there's the extrinsic value, so the and the intrinsic value. So, and what I'm really talking about there is the obvious value. I'm able to flow energy from a high price, could be 10, to a lower price, from a lower price to a higher price, which could be 5. Therefore, the difference is 5. So that capacity is worth 5 to me. But also, I might be buying that 2 years out, and the price could change many different times. It could reverse. So, you know, what was the highest price becomes the lowest price, or it could widen, it could narrow. And of course, that's the flexibility value. Mm-hmm. So the people who bid in to buy our capacity will have to take a view on what that's worth, right? Mm-hmm. The auctions where we sell our capacity are typically oversubscribed. And, you know, we try our best to get as much value as we can, because for that capacity, and that will depend on us, of course, also being reliable operators. They know the capacity is going to turn up, right? And they're going to be able to flow the energy. But we're super keen to do that because we operate under something called a cap and floor scheme, which means over a certain amount of return, all the money we earn goes back to consumers in the UK. And we, this is something that is incredibly motivating for us.
Okay, well, let's track the money first. So so you've built the cable, you've put in a big amount of CapEx into building this project, often splitting that sort of CapEx investment with someone else who typically owns 50% of it. Mm-hmm. Then you have these auctions to sell off that capacity, and you have them from, say, years ahead to sort of day ahead. That money then comes in to you, and then you are then sort of looking at that money and saying, okay, it's then assessed in terms of a cap and floor. So
that's right.
With the cap and floor, if it's below the floor, then it would get topped up to the floor, and so there's kind of the investment certainty. If it's above the cap, and maybe let's talk about the above the cap example, like where does that money go?
Okay,
who do you pay it to?
Yeah, so maybe just to set some parameters around the cap and floor. The cap and floor is a 25-year regulatory deal for interconnectors, so different to the tenure of CFDs, for example, mm-hmm. which are, I think, what,
15, yeah. But hot topic, though, people are very excited to make them 25.
Yeah, 25 years, and they are, so the National Grid has four assets operating under cap and floor, and they are reconciled, if you like, every 5 years.
Okay.
So the money flows, right? Years 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And at the end of 5 years, you true up, right? So what were the costs? What returns did you make? Are you needing to be topped up because you've performed under the floor, or are you needing to hand some money back? And all our interconnectors under cap and floor are operating over the cap.
Okay.
And if I take the interconnector that actually was the first cap and floor interconnector in the UK, Nemo Link, this is an interconnector to Belgium. It's now in year 6.5. So it's gone through its first kind of true up, its first 5 year assessment period. And we gave, I think, about 90 million
okay.
to consumers at the end of that period, right?
Okay.
And what that means is that it goes through, it's almost like a credit that you give to network charges on consumer bills. It goes through NESO, who are responsible for managing TNUOS and network charges on bills. And it's kind of like a deducting item. So we're really pleased that we've been able to achieve that kind of performance. It looks like we're going to be achieving similar performance on our other interconnectors of the first period. Of course, we're aware. We're talking about a 25-year regulatory deal, so you know it's incredibly difficult to predict the future. But what we can, I guess, state is the rigor and the robustness of the regulatory design. You know, a few years ago, when we were operating these assets with incredibly volatile and high prices, we weren't under the same scrutiny that others were at that time with making extraordinary profits, because we were, you know, we were fortunate enough to be having very wide spreads between the highest and the lowest priced countries that our interconnectors operate. But we know that we're capped out at a certain percentage, and all this money was going to consumers. So we were able to announce 300 million that we were estimating in totality going through to consumers.
It feels a shame that it gets rolled into TNUOS. Sorry, we've said TNUOS, Transmission Network Use of System Charges. It's quite a dull acronym, that one. but it seems a shame that it gets rolled into TNUOS, because wouldn't it be lovely if a customer saw on their bill, they said, oh, look, interconnection, like minus £6, you know, for this year, or like whatever it might be. That for them...
I'm writing it down.
Well, yeah, But also, I think this perhaps leads into a question that we're coming towards around the Norwegian interconnection,
yeah.
which is really what sort of takes 10 years to build this thing. Huge amounts of effort, huge amounts of capital. But then also the life of these projects. We're talking, you know, multiple decades for these projects, and you have to manage those relationships. And it feels that in some regions, if you don't necessarily have consumers feeling a £6 saving or a £10 saving per year, but are just perhaps feeling that this interconnection is just causing problems on their grid, they might want to get rid of them.
Yeah.
How do you manage that relationship?
Yeah, so I mean, we have a very long-standing relationship with Statnett, who are our partner on North Sea Link, which is the Norwegian interconnector, and they're incredibly sensitive to the sentiment of Norwegian consumers and the political concerns that there are on the Norwegian link. I guess that what's interesting is when you see the reported sentiment about consumers fearing how much the interconnection to the UK is driven at prices, they don't recall the amount of the amount of money that they are making from the and where that money's going from North Sea Link, because it's been significant over since it's been in operation since 2021. Equally, there has been periods where Norway has had shortages of hydro reserves and has been importing. Those periods can be in quite short term, particular times of particular months or days. But again, if we look back in 2022, there was quite a significant Norwegian hydro drought. It was when there was a perfect storm with the nuclear outage and prices across, and you know, of course, the the gas price issue caused by the invasion of Ukraine. And we actually exported, I think, about 1.4 terawatt hours during quite a short period to Norway to help them with security of supply issues they had at that time. Yeah. So I think it's really interesting how the reactions we get to quite particular moments in time when we're talking about assets that are actually designed to operate much longer than the 25-year regulatory deal. I mean, IFA, our first interconnector, is now in year 39. Okay. And, you know, I think that the energy systems will change in years to come. Where we see, actually, for the Norwegian link, we believe that the peak of Norwegian demand will probably surpass their hydro in the late 2020s. So they're looking at their energy strategy at the moment. And if we go to roll forward to the 2030s, we believe they're going to be the recipients of plentiful cheap wind from the UK, because we've gone a lot faster with our wind build out. So you could see things really change. So the importance is to really take a strategic view, a infrastructure 10-year view, yes, and to really understand how this could play out in generations to come.
It's really interesting. We had someone on called Riku Merikoski very recently, who was talking about Nordic power markets, and he was obviously from the other side appealing to people to say, hey, look, you know, let's think about the UK system, because if they go ahead and build a huge amount of offshore wind, and they're looking like they will, a lot of that will come through at a wholesale power price, which is close to zero. Obviously, the sort of end cost to the consumer is linked to the contracts for difference scheme, and so it is still paid for by consumers. But the price, the wholesale price, could be zero. And so for Norway, this could be a very good opportunity for them to be able to import those prices.
Yeah. And, you know, as we were talking about before, the conditions for building offshore wind in Norway are much more challenging than they are in the UK. Mm-hmm. So we maybe in the future we'll see more offshore hybrid assets going to Norway, which pick up UK wind, but don't just connect it to the UK, but connect it over to Norway as well. So they have different markets to go to. So helps security of supply, provides cheap power to other countries, and also releases constraint costs on the UK grid. So lots and lots of consumer benefits there.
Okay. I have two final questions before my two final questions. But my first, my fourth final question is a very straightforward one, which is, what is the end life of these interconnectors? So you mentioned 39 years for IFA. How long might that run for?
So we see that with the right maintenance capex and refurbishment, that we could potentially keep IFA going until the 2050s. So I guess what's important to know is that's not just a national grid decision, right? We can have the shiniest asset on our coast as we wanted, but if the RTE side of the asset wasn't maintained, that wouldn't really be a sensible strategy. So it really enforces the partnership that you have, you know, not just in developing and delivering and constructing the assets, but in maintaining them for decades. And we've been very fortunate to partner with European TSOs who have very similar values and huge, incredible engineering teams and asset management teams and security and resilience philosophies and obligations similar to our own. So that finding that partner you can operate with. So I think it is really key. So we believe there's a case for getting a lot more safe life out of IFA, continue to deliver benefits for consumers. Really important to note that IFA is an example of an asset that paybacks its capex a long time ago and operates under a different regulatory scheme. Essentially, half the profits from the asset go to consumers. So it's another one where we have been able to declare significant value for customers in the years.
So In the run-up to this episode, I received a text from Laurent, who said, pass his regards to Rebecca. And I thought, excellent. And I saw you on Redefining Energy last year, which is a great episode for anyone looking to sort of expand their knowledge further about interconnection. I know Laurent is looking at longer cables. So there's potential to, say, connect the UK to the US. How likely do you think that is?
So I was in Helsinki about a month and a half ago with one of the world's largest vessel manufacturers and cabling manufacturers, Prysmian, to celebrate the launch of their new ship and to actually get on board and take a look around it, right? This is a huge ship that they announced is capable of laying cable 2,000 meters below sea, right? So if you think about having ships capable of performing all these activities, so digging the trench, laying the cables, securing the cables at those kind of depths, then you are, and we know we've got the cable which we're seeing in front of us, which is produced to withstand, you know, those kind of sea conditions and with not too heavy losses, then we firmly believe those kind of projects are possible. And yeah, we're really excited about the innovators who are coming to the market, such as Laurent and others, and looking at connecting much more uncorrelated markets across much further distances. There's nothing from a technical perspective that we can see would hinder that, would stop that project being successful.
Feels like a system operator's dream to be able to connect the UK to New York ISO or to ERCOT, let's say. Like, just they're so uncorrelated that it would be fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's all about the price. Okay, so moving on to the two final questions. So is there anything you'd like to plug?
I would like to plug markets. So I think that we are moving into a world with increased and necessary strategic planning and across, you know, energy vectors, networks. But I operate a business where the benefits of markets are clear every single day. And I just don't think in energy, when it comes to policy, regulation, we amplify the benefits of markets to consumers, the benefits of attracting investment, innovators, you know, appropriate commercial signals in energy. And I think it's one of the beautiful things about the UK the UK energy context for so long, and let's just please not destroy markets.
Okay, interesting. Julian Leslie, who came on, who is essentially overseeing the SSEP, Strategic Spatial Energy Planning in the UK, had that as his contrarian view, which was pushing for markets. So it's certainly not something that's lost on people, for sure. Maybe just to inquire a little bit about that. So by markets, what is missing, or what are you worried about losing from markets?
So an example would be, we can build all the fantastic infrastructure we want, but if we don't operate it according to economic market signals, then one could quickly see the consumer value dissipate from that infrastructure. So, you know, if we think about the UK moving forward with market reforms that aren't in line with Europe, for example, okay, what does that leave infrastructure like offshore wind, like interconnection, and how will that flow electrons, will that be suboptimal for consumers going forward? Mm-hmm. I think that we really do need to take a step back and understand the interplay with markets and infrastructure for the future energy system we're building.
Okay, so maybe just to put this into an example, if you had, say, a large subsidy scheme paying for wind, but outside of the wholesale market, and if you had that in the UK, but also in another country that we were connected to, that you can in theory have wind being paid in both regions, but the wholesale price in both regions being zero. And then for you as someone who's selling capacity on an interconnector, well, if the price is zero in both regions, well, then like, what can you do?
Exactly.
But actually, that market is paying money to those generators to turn up and to generate, but it's just not being seen in the market.
Exactly.
So the more you resolve off market, the sort of worse that could become.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are plenty of assets where optimization really depends. It's the easiest way to optimize and to, as I say, deliver value for the investor, but also for consumers as a whole and the wider energy system, is to have appropriate market schemes setting the incentives. That can be whether it's ancillary ancillary services, that we're, you know, flexibility markets, general wholesale markets. There's plenty of examples. Let's not kill the markets just because we're building lots of infrastructure.
Okay, I love that plug. And moving on to a final question, which is there a contrarian view you hold? So something that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
So I was saying earlier that I would describe myself as a hypercritical contrarian, so I could list these off. But the key one I'd like to voice here would be the UK can develop as thorough a domestic network plan as it would like if it doesn't connect to other European, particularly, you know, North Sea countries. It's not finished. Mm-hmm. It's not thorough. It's not thought through, and it won't be operable for the benefit of for the optimal benefit of consumers in the future. So we have to start recognizing the importance that an interconnected grid with Europe plays now and increasingly so in the future, as we've just spoken about. For, you know, the absolute basics of our energy system, we've got to work in a coordinated way with them, from policy to project development, infrastructure development, market reform, you know, etc. going forward. So I really, really hope to see a bit more coming from the NESO strategic plans that don't just stop midway in the North Sea where the UK territory ends, but sees how that joins up to other grids and understands how that's going to flow through too. I think I'm hearing wild assumptions sometimes about how interconnectors will flow and what's happening on other grids. And then I go and talk to our partners about the challenges they have or whether they've had these conversations with the UK, and we just don't seem joined up. So let's join up. Let's take the opportunity to really take a more holistic view, not just an solely UK domestic view when we're doing the strategic planning.
Yeah, I think that's a great endpoint to leave it on. Rebecca, thank you for being our first bringer of a prop, our first hypercritical contrarian, and a fantastic guest all around. I'm sure our listeners will have learned a huge amount. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.